This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Academy Awards are just days away. The star-studded celebration is a time to honor the best in film. Up for an Oscar this year, well, all familiar names like Leonardo DiCaprio and actress Jennifer Lawrence. But a lack of diversity in the nominees has spurred controversy in the prestigious awards. None of the acting nominees are people of color. So before cinephiles rush to watch all the movies for Best Picture, that are up for Best Picture, I should say, we ask, what did the Academy miss this year? For this installment of Movies on the Radio, we'll take a look at some of the performances and categories overlooked by the Oscars. Joining me, as always, are film experts Laura Boies and Marcia Gordon. Laura is film curator at North Carolina's Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film studies professor at North Carolina State. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
So we're going to talk about kind of what was left out and what they didn't do. But, I mean, the fact is, look, what are the Oscars? I mean, let's take a look at what they really intend to do.
Yeah, well, you used the operative word, which is this is where the industry recognizes its best work. Now, best is probably one of the most subjective terms you can imagine, right? We, I think, all feel very strongly in different ways about films. I love it, you hate it, whatever. So the people who vote and nominate are just people. They just happen to be in the industry. And so one of the questions is, you know, when you put the kind of hive mind together, are they really coming up with what, you know, other people might think are the best? And that's where we get into some of these tensions. It is a flawed and imperfect process.
And an insider's look at what is ultimately fiction on fiction on fiction. So let's not take it so seriously, folks.
Well, I've loved the Oscars since I was a little girl, while recognizing they're completely pointless.
Yeah, there you go.
And many of the great filmmakers and actors were never recognized by the Academy Awards. And you can start right at the top with Alfred Hitchcock,
yep,
who never won an Oscar. So while the Academy is celebrating, you know, twinkling Irish priests and Going My Way, the movies that really last are often quite often ignored by the Academy.
And let's also keep in mind that, you know, say for Best Actor, so you have, you know, actors not doing write-in nominations of who they think put on the best performances. Well, that's based on what they've seen, right? And so what they haven't seen is a whole other thing. And it's always been more about what's commercial and mainstream. Every now and then, one of those independent or smaller pictures bubbles into these categories. But typically, they just get left, you know.
Because everyone in the Academy gets a giant stack of, may we suggest, DVDs that they can watch in the comfort of their own home. But when they get their glass of Chardonnay after dinner, are they going to watch Beasts of No Nation with Idris Elba? I think probably not.
Well, and also there's a real difference between watching movies at home and watching them in a theater. So that's a whole other thing. So cinematography, for example, that is something that really good cinematography is meant to be seen on a big screen. Not that I think these people have 13-inch televisions in their homes, but still, the point being is it's a different experience.
All of that said, it is a reflection on American culture in one way or another, and for that reason, worth thinking about and worth examining. So what does the lineup look like this year to you, Marcia?
Well, I mean, as has been pointed out over and over again, it is a very white lineup. There are no women in the Best Director category. There are lots of elisions, and there's lots, you know, but there is actually, if you look at the films that are up for Best Picture, there's actually kind of a nice range. Room was a relatively small film compared to, you know, The Martian or The Revenant. And you know, you have journalism films, you have revenge films, you have melodramas. So there is a range. It's not just one kind of film that's being attended to.
In a giant step forward, the Academy did see fit to put a woman in the Best Actress category for the first time in, I think, 30 years. Laura, what about this? Some of the big movies that I just say things like that.
All the time.
You know how I care about film. But the big movies that on your list this year?
Well, I enjoyed some of the movies that, you know, are on the Best Picture list. I enjoyed The Big Short and Bridge of Spies and Brooklyn and Spotlight.
And I thought Mad Max Fury Road, actually, which I've been teaching to my introduction to film students this semester, for a big budget, super high action, intense film, also had a lot to say about the world. And I think Charlize Theron was fantastic in it. I mean, I would say of those kind of bigger action films, I thought that was a really fantastic, rises to the top for me.
Well, our question to listeners for this program was what categories were left out? What do you think should have been a category that wasn't included this year? And here's some of what we got.
Hi, my name is Sally Bloom, and I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. What I really wanted to talk about were awards that I'd love to see in the Oscars. One is for ensemble acting, because that award would recognize films where the synergy of the whole cast came together to create a really strong performance, especially recognizing films that maybe there wasn't a particular lead, but a good group. And for this year, for example, movies like Spotlight would fit into this category. That would take some of the pressure off of who to nominate, maybe for like Best Supporting Actor or Actress. This year, Mark Ruffalo is nominated, whereas I really think their whole cast should be nominated.
We got to go with this now.
No, I'm not going to rush the story, Mike.
We don't have a choice, Robbie. If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher the story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
So let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We got to nail these scumbags. We got to show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
That's a clip from the 2015 movie Spotlight. My guests are film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyes. It's Movies on the Radio. So much for your priest with twinkling blue eyes.
Exactly. I wasn't thinking of that when I said that. The idea that these categories are written in stone is not true. I mean, the Academy adds and subtracts categories all the time. Like the category for Best Animated Film came about because they were afraid that Disney's Beauty and the Beast was actually going to win Best Picture the year that it came out. And there used to be an Oscar for Best Artistic Production, which is something that has also fallen by the wayside.
I really like Sally's suggestion, though. I think it recognizes something that makes sense as a category because it's true. So many of these films, you know, one person gets nominated, and it's never one person. I mean, and that's kind of the great mythology of Hollywood, that the director or there's some individual that makes it happen. It is the most collaborative of all possible creative enterprises. And the idea of actually having a way to say, look, this all the pieces of this performance puzzle had to come together in order for this film to be great is a fantastic one. Academy, take note.
It's a way to recognize also films that wouldn't win in any other category except that this ensemble did a great thing, although it didn't raise the film to Best Film or any of the actors to, you know, any of those individual categories. So the other thing that does get left out, interestingly enough, and I had not thought about this until I heard this next clip, is that genre really isn't recognized. Let's listen.
This is Glenn McDonald in Chapel Hill, and what I'd like to see is a category dedicated to science fiction, mostly because I'm just a science fiction nerd from forever, and my vote would be Ex Machina, which was a great treatment of artificial intelligence, and I just loved it because it's a kind of a modern day riff on the Frankenstein story, but with high tech labs and mad scientists and troublesome artificial intelligence.
Do you know what the Turing test is?
Yeah, I know what the Turing test is. It's when a human interacts with a computer, and if the human doesn't know they're interacting with a computer, the test is passed.
And what does the past tell us?
That the computer has artificial intelligence. Are you building an AI?
I've already built one. And over the next few days, you're going to be the human component in the Turing test.
Hi. I'm Caleb.
Hello, Caleb.
Do you have a name?
Yes. Ava. What will happen to me if I fail your test?
Ava.
Will it be bad?
I don't know.
Do you think I might be switched off because I don't function as well as I'm supposed to?
Ava, I don't know the answer to your question. It's not up to me.
Why is it up to anyone? Do you have people to test you or might switch you off?
No, I don't.
Then why do I?
it's got great thrills and twists, but it's more about ideas than action, and it takes its science seriously.
That's a clip from the science fiction flick Ex Machina, and my guests today, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyce. Marcia, what about that? I guess no real categories are honored.
No, and I mean, Ex Machina, which I thought was a very, very interesting, well-done film. It is up for screenplay. It's up for visual effects. Of course, the problem with this, as much as I like the idea, is the awards are always too long anyways. Imagine if we had a category for every genre. It's impossible. We would be up till 4 in the morning.
I think they need to take out best sound editing. And then we'd have time.
Then we'd have room. Start peeling off some. Now, all the sound editors are going to be really unhappy with you.
That's the only one I like. Don't leave that one out today on the side.
But, you know, it is really important to think about what gets marginalized. Yeah. I think something that we talked about and has come up is comedy, for example. Rarely. There are comedies that have, of course, been nominated. But it's rarely taken as seriously as dramas. So, you know, they tend to get marginalized by the process, even though they're really important films.
Plus, I really wish I could have seen Amy Schumer get a screenplay nomination for Trainwreck, which I thought was hilarious. Plus, it had the best performance by a supporting actor who was also a professional athlete with LeBron James.
We'll have to I didn't get that film at all. We'll have to talk about that.
We'll talk about that on the state of things. Movies on the Radio today. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boyce on Movies on the Radio talking about the Oscars and what was left out. Just ahead, we continue our look with your picks as well on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest film experts, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyce. Movies on the Radio, we're talking about performances and categories that were overlooked at this year's Oscars. We asked our listeners what they thought, and here's what one said.
My name is Rose Hollinshead. I'm from Cary, North Carolina. And if I were to give an Oscar this year, I would give it to Fiona Weir, who is the casting director for not only the movie Room, but also for the movie Brooklyn. Two outstanding movies in a very good field this year. The casting for any movie is really crucial. I think it was especially important in the movie Room because this 9-year-old child is practically in every frame of the movie, and it would not have been nearly as believable had he not been so effective in the role.
Do you remember how Alice wasn't always in Wonderland?
She fell down, 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 deep in a hole.
Right, well, I wasn't always in Room. I'm like Alice. I was a little girl named Joy.
Nah.
And I lived in a house with my mom and my dad. You would call them Grandma and Grandpa.
What house?
A house. It was in the world. And there was a backyard, and we had a hammock. We would swing in the hammock and we would eat ice cream.
A TV house?
No, Jack, a real house, not TV. Are you even listening to me? When I was a little older, when I was 17, I was walking home from school.
Where was I?
You were still up in heaven, but there was a guy. He pretended that his dog was
what
sick.
What guy?
Old Nick. We call him Old Nick. I don't know what his real name is. But he pretended his dog was sick.
What's the dog's name?
Jack, there wasn't a dog. He was trying to trick me, okay? There wasn't a dog. Old Nick stole me.
I want a different story.
No, this is the story that you get. He put me in his garden shed. Here, Room is the shed.
I think that casting directors, in general, there should be a category. I think they are arguably more crucial to the success of a movie than, say, hair and makeup, and there's Oscars for those, also for costuming. The actors that are ultimately cast in a movie, to me, is what makes the movie work or not work.
There's a nomination for the category casting director, and using the movie Room as a good example. What about that, Marcia, the idea of that kind of category? How important is the casting?
Well, obviously, it's very, very important. I think Rose's articulation of why is fantastic. And, I mean, it does raise the issue how those decisions get made. Why is it that it's director and cinematographer and visual effects and, you know, these other categories that get privileged over others? And in this case, it seems to be there's no rhyme or reason. I don't know the answer to this particular question.
I think because it's supposed to happen by magic. And that once you deconstruct it into it's somebody's job to pick you, it seems
But you could say the same thing about costume or makeup or cinematography. It's all smoke and mirrors. So.
And Rose's comment raised a question for me that I've never asked because I've always assumed that the director, at least when it comes to the leads, has first say in that. Is that not always true? Do you know?
I mean, in studio history, the answer would have been no when a producer would have had the ultimate say over everything. But now they would be, I would assume, deeply involved in any process. But the casting director would be the connection between the director and the actor, unless they already know who they have in mind for the role.
Well, let's play a clip from you've also picked Best Casting Director, Laura, as your
candidate. I have. My idea was not alone.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the film that you chose. This would be a film, a little known indie flick called Star Wars that came out last year.
Who are you?
I'm no one.
Follow me.
Nothing will stand in our way. I'll show them the dark side.
I don't know your name.
Finn, what's yours?
I'm Rey.
There you go. A clip from Star Wars, The Force Awakens. Film experts Marsha Gordon, Laura Boies today. Movies on the radio. And you also thought casting director is a good category, and that film should have gotten the award.
And this is why. Because Hollywood knowledge has always said that the international blockbusters, which run Hollywood these days, they only care about whether they can make their billions, not just here, but overseas. That global audiences will not pay to watch a movie unless a white man is the star. And in Star Wars, there's an African-American man, a Latino man, and a woman who are the three key characters who are going to be taking Star Wars into the next iteration. And it became, I think, at the moment, only Titanic still has outpaced it as the world's biggest grossing film. So they took a chance on the fact that, yes, global audiences do want to see a diverse cast. And I have to say, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, so I'm sorry if you haven't seen Star Wars yet, but when the climactic battle between good and evil, and evil Kylo Ren is doing battle with a woman wielding a Jedi sword, I mean, my eyes filled with tears. It's like I've been waiting my whole life to see a woman defend good on screen in this way. And the fact that all the toy manufacturers have left her out of so much of the merchandise shows they really did not understand how powerful this would be to this whole new generation of girls that say, yes, I can be the hero in my own life.
It's Hunger Games stuff, too. I mean, that's...
Hunger Games is in a lesser category than Star Wars, because Star Wars is a global brand the way that these other franchises just are not.
Did Hunger Games, though, has kind of become that?
I would think that Hunger Games would have a comparable reach, but I don't know.
But the other question is whether or not, and you know I'm more cynical about this, because to me, having the black man and the woman and the, you know, is the Disney way. I mean, that's just a small world after all. So yes, that's exactly what Disney would do. Marsha, perhaps because the time has come that there is this also longing for diversity, which of course, is a question swirling around the Oscars this year, the lack of diversity.
Right. Well, no, I mean, I think this is a question of our times, and it's reflected in what gets made into films and then what gets recognized at things like the Academy Awards, which, frankly, one of the reasons it matters is because it does once a year put a spotlight on what this group of people in this rarefied industry have decided is the best and most important. And when it doesn't reflect what is being made, when it doesn't reflect, you know, what people are seeing, when it doesn't reflect the diversity of our culture, that's when it starts raising questions.
And the question is around the push and pull of a business like the film industry, which on the one hand wants to make money doing what it has always done. On the other hand, has to be on the cusp of a trend. And if it sees a trend, it wants to be sort of not left behind. And so and also because it is then guilty of reinforcing whatever prejudices and stereotypes that hold us back. So if it's doing it for the money and it happens to reinforce a stereotype, they just throw up their hands and point to their stockholders. But so let me ask you, Laura, if you think this really means they have sort of struck a blow for diversity, or if they're really reading a trend that,
well,
that's about time.
Well, I think it has to be both of them. But the fact that, you know, since the 1970s, Star Wars has been so dominant in science fiction culture all over the world, and people have read themselves into the characters of Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, regardless of their gender or ethnicity, and now that they have another way to look at that, I really think that's very important.
Well, let's talk to another listener, listen to another listener who had an idea about diversity and his choice this year.
This is Neil Morris. I live in Fuquay Varina, and I'm a film critic for Indie Week. Not only would I have nominated Idris Elba for Best Supporting Actor for his role in Beasts of No Nation, but it's being held up as one of several examples of worthy potential nominees of color who were ignored by the Academy this year and in previous years due to institutional racial bias. In fact, Elba was ignored last year for his starring role in Mandela Long Walk to Freedom. And that's an issue that deserves much discussion and much change.
Young men, well, we will not wait to inherit any wealth. We will not wait for them to come and give it to us.
No, no sir.
We are going to take it.
Yes, sir.
We're going to take it from them.
Yes, sir.
Seize it.
Yes, sir.
All of you that have never been listened to before and have seen your family killed, you now have something that stands for you. You now have something that stands for you.
There's another aspect to Elba's omission that's not getting as much attention, but I think is interesting in its own right. Beast of No Nation was distributed by Netflix, who chose to make the film available on its online streaming platform at the same time that it put it into limited release in movie theaters. That angered the largest theater chains in the country, who had enjoyed a partnership and an agreement to get first crack at distribution. And because of that, they chose to boycott Beast of No Nation. It appears that the Academy, populated by Hollywood movie industry insiders, has chosen to follow suit and deny Beast of No Nation any nominations for its highest award.
A conversation around Beast of No Nation as we talk about the Oscars and what got left out today on movies on the radio. Marsha, what about that? I mean, the industry's changing. Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we are at a pivotal moment in terms of distribution and exhibition of films. And I think Neil is right to point to that as being a significant issue. That this I think, that is a film that I think we may look back at in 10 years and go, that was one of the game changers in this kind of subversion of the traditional means of getting films into theaters. And, you know, the studios are scared. Theaters are scared. Everyone is trying to figure out how they are going to control the market. And so that is an issue. And then the kind of race issue is a whole other matter. And, you know, it's been widely publicized that in January, the Academy president, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, made a commitment on the Academy's behalf that there would be a doubling, an increase in the kind of diversity of Academy voters by, I think it's 2020. And so there are things in the works that have been brought about by the kind of attention that's being paid to the exclusion of this year's nominees that are very positive and productive.
Well, I think part of the reason that Netflix chose to distribute the film this way because they were hoping for the largest possible audience. And this is a very difficult and bleak film in which traumatized children are taught to hack other people to death with machetes. And this is a very tough sell no matter what your platform is.
Let's play a clip from a listener who chose Spike Lee's latest film.
I'm Jonathan Kahana. And my choice of a film that should receive an Oscar nomination and didn't is Chi-Raq, the Spike Lee film from this past year, which I think was the best picture of the year because it really felt like a movie, whereas some of the other films about contemporary history felt to me like recitations of NPR or PBS stories that I already knew very well. Chi-Raq is it's entertainment made for the big screen. It's the kind of thing that Hollywood used to do really well. It combines spectacle, it combines genres, it's a comedy, and a musical. It's a social problem film. And it's a film that you really need to see in the theater, that needs a big screen, which is something that Hollywood is not so good at anymore.
When a murderer walks free, we are all in danger. But if multiple folks come forward, multiple folks who witness these murders, there is no one target. What makes someone a target is not the shooter. What makes someone a target is the community that surrenders to fear and becomes silent.
It's also a film that I think is confusing to a lot of viewers, and I can imagine that it's quite confusing to the Academy or to the industry, not least because it's about a contemporary problem and it doesn't seem to have a solution to that problem, and because it's a film that fills the screen with black women, which I can imagine is also quite frightening for the Academy or for a lot of audiences.
I can change, Shy.
Darling, people change when they decide to change.
Make it sound so easy.
All you can do is create an environment for change. Like an alcoholic, you take away his booze.
You just try taking away their guns.
All right. Well, what else do they love?
Getting turned up, making money.
What else? Yeah, well.
There's a clip from the Spike Lee film Chi-Raq, and my guest today, film experts Marsha Gordon, Laura Boies, Movies on the Radio, talking about the Oscars, What Got Left Out. By the way, I was not hurt by Jonathan's reference to public radio.
I saw the look on your face.
No, no, I mean, it just means we are not only a movie, and that's a good thing. But to the larger point, I mean, we can talk about race and diversity at the Academy, but what about Spike Lee's legacy? Where does this film what does that do you think, for his legacy?
Well, I think Spike Lee is one of the most interesting contemporary filmmakers, and he does push the boundaries. This is a film I actually have mixed feelings about, but I'm very convinced by Jonathan's argument. My recollection, was it in theaters here?
Just for a heartbeat.
Yeah, so, I mean, talk about the Beasts of No Nation distribution paradigm. I wanted to see this on a big screen, and I don't know if I just missed the 1 week, but, I mean, things come and go so quickly that you don't even have the opportunity to see them, and so this is an example of that. But I mean, I think the fact that it's a very imaginative, it is boundary pushing. It makes you feel uncomfortable at times. I love the creativity of the screenplay, and it just got no recognition.
Well,
whatsoever.
And you should say what it's about is that it's a redoing of the Greek play Lysistrata, in which women decide to withhold sex from their men until they stop waging war. And Spike Lee has always been a provocateur. And in a way, I think he does not want to be included in the establishment. In a way, he would feel he would have failed if all of the conservative voters of the Academy thought that this was worthy of some sort of official recognition.
It also has a way, though, of then suppressing distribution, because the awards, if they do nothing else, sort of enhance your possibility of getting seen.
Yeah, and, you know, this is also circular. I mean, last year, one of the big conversations was about Ava DuVernay's Selma, which was up for Best Picture, but she, a woman of color, did not get nominated for Best Director. And if you look at the overlap between Best Picture and Best Director, there's only one film this year that did not get nominated for Best Director that got nominated for Best Picture. So it begins to raise these questions.
However, Disney's just tapped her to do A Wrinkle in Time, so perhaps her career is taking a different turn because of that sort of publicity.
Well, yeah. here's another clip from a film featuring a black actor and a black director, but that received few nominations this year.
This is Isaac Weeks calling from Nashville, Tennessee. My choice for perhaps an overlooked film this award season was Creed. Ryan Coogler's is kind of sort of reboot of the Rocky franchise, with Michael B. Jordan's performance as the title character Creed was the star-making performance of the year.
How good was he?
Apollo, yeah, he was great. He's a perfect fighter. Ain't nobody ever better.
So how'd you beat him?
Time beat him. Time, you know, takes everybody out. It's undefeated. Anyway, I got a lot.
So when Mickey died, he came and talked to you, right? Talked you out of quitting, took you to L.A., trained you, brought you back.
How do you know all this?
How do you think?
What are you, like a cousin?
He's my father.
Coogler did great work there. One of the best directorial performances that I saw all year, as well as co-writing the screenplay. Coogler really should have been nominated for those two things.
What about that, Marcia?
Well, this is not the only listener who feels this way. This has been a much talked about decision for this particular film because Sylvester Stallone got tapped for best performance, and yet Michael B. Jordan did not. The director did not. And so this is one of those cases is why is this film, which is called Creed, by the way, the emphasis on his character. Why does Stallone, the yeah. white guy, get the nomination and everyone else falls to the wayside?
Well, I think the critical thing is not just that he's white, but that he's also old, because the Oscars love dragging out aging stars onto their stage and give them one last chance in the spotlight before their inevitable decline.
Well, and it's habit and expectation, and that's what you get to when you talk about Spike Lee pushing the envelope, giving us films that make us feel uncomfortable. Our habit and expectation for a film is that's not what it will do.
Right.
So the awards are going to go to the ones that sort of remind us of what a film should be like. We'll talk more about that on The State of Things with Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys. Movies on the Radio continues in a moment. Down the red carpet with a former producer who used to work with Joan Rivers. We'll talk about that as well as we look at the Oscars on Movies on the Radio. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The Oscars are this weekend. It means it's time to roll out the red carpet. The allure of the red carpet has dazzled audiences for decades as they watch movie stars and celebrities parade into the award show. We're talking about it today on Movies on the Radio with Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon. One person who changed the rules on the red carpet was Joan Rivers, the comedian who died in 2014. She is remembered as a television host with an attitude that didn't hold back. Joining us now to talk about the legacy of Joan Rivers on the red carpet is Billy Warden. Billy's a former producer and writer for E! Entertainment Television's Red Carpet Specials with Joan. He is also co-founder of the Triangle-based public relations and communications company GBW Strategies. Welcome back, Billy Warden.
Thank you, Frank. And I think if Joan were here, she'd say, Frank, you are the embodiment of NPR chic. You look very smart. And also very, very underpaid.
What I wanted her to hear her say is thin, but she wouldn't say that about me. How did she change the rules? Well, first of all, what did you do for the show? I want to know kind of what your job was.
I got there almost as soon as Joan got there, the second year that she started bomb throwing on the red carpet. And I was a disgruntled screenwriter. I had worked on a screenplay for a year with a couple of producers. It didn't happen.
Means you got fired a lot, right?
I got fired a lot. Okay. I was laying on the futon in Los Angeles. Yeah. I was flicking around the cable networks, and I saw Ian. I called him, and I said, listen, I can write. I was a newspaper reporter. You guys need some writers. I've been watching it for the last 6 hours.
Oh, they always like to hear that. And that got you the job. So tell us what her role is. I mean, how she changed things with this red carpet. All these stars pulling up in their limos, and we'd watch them. And then she starts asking them questions, right?
That's right. E! Wanted to differentiate itself. We had Entertainment Tonight to compete with, Entertainment Weekly. We wanted to take you inside showbiz, but with some grit in the glamour. And who could be more gritty than Joan Rivers? Joan was sort of on a downswing in her roller coaster career. She wanted back on television, and the red carpet was a perfect platform, right? Because she was always about taking the celebrities to task. So we put them together, and the terror began.
Let's listen to an example. Here she is in 1997.
We're back, and we're here with Bill Macy and Felicity Huffman and Angie Everhart, who we started talking to before. And you're up for Best Supporting Actor. First nomination?
First time, yes.
Very exciting.
It's very exciting. This is huge. It's insanity.
It's insane. Have you been here before?
No, I'm a...
It's a mad rush. I mean, I've never seen anything like this in my life. Who did you text me? Armani.
It's an Armani.
Okay, and
that's
who did you address?
I'm going to marry her.
Mark Wong-Narr. Are you engaged?
Yes, we are.
Do you have a ring? Let's see the ring.
Your
all right.
Ring.
That's your mother's ring. That's lovely. Good luck. Get a bigger ring.
There you go. And enjoy the show. Was that all spontaneous? I mean, how much of that was scripted, and was she ready to go?
We came up with tons and tons of jokes. The staff at E! And her two writers, and then most of those jokes went out the window. And it was just Joan with the celebrities on the red carpet. And the best is when that moment where she looks at the wedding ring, famously she supposedly made Kevin Costner's fiance cry. cry when she insulted the size of the ring and said Kevin Costner ought to be ashamed. When Anthony Hopkins came up and she said, well, Aunt Sir Hopkins, this is wonderful that you brought your mother. And he said, that's my wife.
Well, and you used to feel the phone calls, I understand, afterward from like angry viewers who somehow didn't like what she had to say.
They would just pour in. That's right. And so we had to schedule, you know, the days after these things to take those calls and talk them through. But they were also very encouraging. I remember one woman from Iowa or something saying, you know, this Joan is disgusting. What she says is vile. It should be off the air. And I know every minute of it is awful because I watched all 4 hours.
Well, this, I mean, and let me talk to you about this too, Marcia and Laura. I think we touched on this a minute ago. This is fantasy. It is about people and their personas. I understand that they're real human beings, that they have minds. But on that night, they're really only their personas. We cannot take this seriously.
Well, and part of the fun, I miss those days of Joan doing that because the pre was more interesting than the show often. And that is telling you something. I mean, that those were really the golden days of having fun. Yes, you like to see the outfits, but she was hilarious. And she kind of punctured some of that, as Billy was indicating, some of that kind of shine and shimmer that Hollywood's so good at creating.
Yeah, she was just always hilarious. I mean, Hollywood gossip columnists have been mean since the very beginning, but she managed to be mean and be funny at the same time so that she got a little bit of a leeway for that.
And a little turnabout is fair play. You know, the commentary always that why are we talking about women's fashion and not men's? And she did manage to turn that around at least once.
Natalie Portman wearing a Zorro.
The dress is so tight, you can actually see the baby knocking and saying, Mommy, Mommy, why did you do that piece of movie with Ashton Kutcher?
It was nothing. There was also another clip where she actually asked one of the actors, "So who did your tuxedo?" And he apparently didn't know. It was his escort who had the answer.
Joan was as bad for Nick Cage's career as any of those terrible movies he made. She did. She was an equal opportunity insulter. That's for sure. But the stars who came out the best were the ones who played around with her.
Right.
Denzel Washington getting out of his limo and saying, my whole family's been watching you for the last 3 hours, and you know, you better be nice to me. Sharon Stone confiding to Joan that she was actually wearing a Gap turtleneck there on the red carpet. The stars that came out the worst were the ones who, you know, acted terrified. You know, Nicole Kidman saying she was never going to talk to Joan again after Joan said her green dress looked like was puke green. And it was.
Then there are people, you know, like Tina Fey, who basically said they were dressing for Joan Rivers.
Right.
And she upped her game over the years as far as, you know, how chic she looked on the red carpet. So I don't know whether Joan ever took credit for that or not.
She lamented that, actually. Toward the end, she lamented that the stars were starting to look so presentable.
It's getting harder to make jokes.
Exactly. It was not enough fodder out there. Speaking of Tina Fey, one of the high watermarks in the late 90s was in Saturday Night Live. Did a send-up of the Oscar red carpet with Joan. And portraying Joan in that skit was not Tina Fey, but a skeleton, a puppet skeleton. And, as I remember, Joan's reaction was, oh, they were so nice. They made me look so thin.
How did she see this? I mean, she understood it as showbiz, right? This is a show. Did she see this as any kind of role or, you know, that she was on any kind of mission?
She loved fashion. I will say that there were very few stars that she was excited to meet. I think she petered a little pants with Jack Nicholson one time on the red carpet. But mostly she wanted to talk to those designers, Carolina Herrera and Marc Jacobs and Vera Wang. She was a big and authentic fashion aficionado.
She also refused to, I love the way she actually refused to talk about whether you're wearing underwear or whether you have, you know, sort of original equipment, those are your breasts. And she did the whole thing by saying, I would never ask that, and then sort of pointedly said, but, you know, now that we're here.
Well, that's right. And it's a great point that she went after herself as much as anything. So I think her philosophy was always, I'm going to talk about my face being tucked in more than a bedsheet at the Holiday Inn, and then I'll get into what Bab Streisand has done.
Mm-hmm. Well, humor was self-deprecating from her very first stand-ups, you know, that we saw on the Ed Sullivan Show or Johnny Carson or whatever. So she felt that if she was making fun of herself first, that everyone else was fair game as well.
And I think the most fun part of the red carpet stuff is everything during the awards ceremony is so staged and it's so crafted and everything is planned out. And the red carpet was the one place you might see a little bit of authenticity when stars had to react to what was being lobbed at them.
When Joan took a drag off Ian McKellen's cigarette, you know, that those are just great moments where they're real people who need a smoke.
Right.
So I know that you and other staff were actually writing jokes. You were holding the cards, right, for her?
Yeah, we would be crouched down underneath with these cards and have this really interesting vantage point up everybody's nostrils, sort of. And, you know, she would look down and try to read the cards. And, you know, those shows did not come off seamlessly. I mean, she strangled a lot of jokes out there on the red carpet. But we went with lots of ammo, and then it was sort of a free-for-all. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite joke, a joke that you wish would have gotten on? You didn't read that joke, Joan.
My favorite joke was the one where we did a toss to break when you go to commercial, and we did a joke where Joan advised everyone to go get a snack, go pee or go get a snack, or if you're of a particular nationality, go eat your dog. And I mean, and I won't say the nationality again and all that.
But she did.
Yeah, yeah. And we got a letter from the embassy and, you know, all sorts of things.
Well, you could tell how irreplaceable she was when Fashion Police, after she passed away, no one else could do what Joan did. She was just so amazing.
Why do you think it took that long? I mean, the Oscars have been around for a long time, and the appetite for that kind of satire or sort of piercing the bubble certainly has been around.
I think it was the rise of reality TV was the gateway to that sort of don't you think so?
I think that is a great point, that reality TV was on the rise there. I don't know how she'd like the current age that we live in with all the Twitter and the trolling and all that. Mm-hmm. I think that she found her moment exactly right when some of the walls were coming down, but it hadn't completely caved in, and she could still have her platform.
The show moved from E! To TV Guide, right? Did it?
Yeah, we had our ups and downs with Joan, and so there was that time in the late 90s, you know, where she did go off into the wilderness with TV Guide, but she came back. She came back and finished up with E!
Well, she deeply appreciated all of you as staff without any doubt, and when she went to TV Guide, she gave you this testimonial as staff people who made her the star she was. Let's listen to her thank you to all of you, Billy.
I thought I would take this opportunity to thank some very special people. I don't know how many of you know this, but my entire crew followed me over from E! To TV Guide. Yes, for at great financial sacrifices, mainly so Melissa and I can still have sushi during the breaks. And I know the crew's families are watching, so I'd like to take the time to give proper thanks. I'm going to announce each one of the crew's names on national television right now, starting with you. The other one, the big fat ass. Well, they're all so wonderful. They're truly loyal people. There's the sound guy who does a fantastic job, Steve. Tim. Whatever. You know who you are. And the cable guy, George. Mary. Finn. And of course, we have ethnic guys. Hi, ethnic guys. Muchas gracias. Whatever. Arigato. They all look so alike, you know. And the main thing is, we're a mixed bag here. We have our black person. I'm not sure what he does, but we are absolutely colorblind here at TV Guide. Right, black person? Okay, I'm bad with names, but these guys know how much I appreciate them.
So she loved you, huh?
Oh, she did. Well, she was so much fun. I mean, we'd come in and we'd fill up the writer's room with staff and with her folks and just write jokes all day. I mean, get so many jokes, and it was so dirty and nasty by the end. It was just crazy. But she'd always hold up her hand as she was reading the jokes about poor Nicole or, you know, Sharon Sharon Stone or whoever and say, I do this with love. I say it all with love. And I don't know if she meant the celebrities, but I think she really loved the showbiz part of it. I think she loved the glamour of it. And I think she loved her role being the court jester in it all.
How did they feel about her? Do you know? Do you have any sense of how the big stars felt about all this?
Oh, I think some of them just hated her. Yeah. They could, what was the Academy thinking letting her on? And we'd always get wind of, well, this time the stars are really going to get together and they're going to keep her off, or you're going to get placement down by the fire hydrant, you know. And so that was always sort of a threat. We had to walk the line because the feuds were great. You know, the feuds with Nicole Kidman and some of the others were just terrific for ratings and for Jones fodder. But, you know, we did have to be careful because we were invited guests there. And she walked it all those years. She did a fabulous job.
So, Billy, we were talking about categories that were left out today on the state of things. What's your category? What do you think the Academy should be looking at and recognizing that it's not doing right now?
I think a husband's award for a movie to take your intellectual wife to that you might also really enjoy.
Oh.
And I think that's The Big Short. And I'm taking Judge Lucy to see it this weekend.
All right. So there we go on the state of things. The big winners and losers. Anybody have any predictions for, you know, how this is going to on the categories?
The Revenant is going to sweep everything. That's my prediction.
Yeah, take
it
them
seems
all.
To have been doing it so far. So no reason to think they would change.
The legacy, you know, I'm thinking, too, about the fact that wasn't really – there's no real replacement for Joan Rivers, was there, in a sense? It never really
– Well, they brought in Kathy Griffin, who is sort of, you know,
right.
Joan's spiritual daughter. And I think Kathy does a very able job with it. She's not – she doesn't quite have the Joan thing because Joan was middle-aged, and I think that worked in her favor. You know,
right.
She had that. She was a veteran.
Because she wasn't in competition
exactly.
anymore.
Right.
But you also need the status of Joan Rivers, who had been, I mean, we all knew who she was. She'd been a star. You know, you say she had her ups and downs, but she's, well, you know, she certainly filled in for Johnny Carson for all those years.
She was a pioneer. She was a comedy pioneer.
And every time she got introduced, you know, she was always the veteran, you know, comedian. And so I think she's been a veteran comedian for her entire career for some reason.
One of my favorite lines with Joan, she would always say, something went wrong at the little E studio. It's a big step down from the NBC studio when you're Johnny's permanent host. But a light would blow out and, you know, we'd have to go find a light bulb. But she'd just, I should have never pissed off Johnny Carson. What in the world?
Which she did she got her own show, right? That was the problem.
Yeah, she got the Fox offered her a show when she was Johnny's permanent guest host, and they say that she didn't tell Johnny, but Johnny was a prickly character, and he exiled her. But I think it worked out for the best because she eventually wound up on the red carpet, and she was a lovely lady. She was a tough boss. I mean, she wanted reams of jokes, even if she wasn't going to use them. But I remember she was playing in Raleigh, and I said, my mother really wants to come meet you. She remembers you from your Tonight Show, Heidi Abramowitz days, and would you, you know, can she come backstage to meet you? Joan had it all set up. My mother got nervous and didn't go, and then so I get a call from Joan. It was like, not only do I not have a sex life, now I'm being stood up by little old ladies from Mayberry.
Billy Warden, former writer and producer for Joan Rivers on E! Entertainment. He's also the co-founder of the Triangle-based public relations communications company, GBW Strategies. Thank you so much, Billy. Always a pleasure to
love you guys. Thank you.
Also, film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia, a film studies professor at North Carolina State. Laura, the film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
And you will find out more about our program and our next category on Movies on the Radio. Pay attention to our website when we figure out what we're doing next month. You will be the first to know, and you will find it at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.